check session number 23211, reel 1.
Recording number 23211, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Oh, I was born in the lovely town of Hereford.
Which year was this?
Oh, 1914.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Hereford?
Oh, yes, I did, yes. I went to a blue coat school there, and I became a choir boy at the cathedral. And I also, of course, took part in all sorts of little activities. I went in for rowing on the beautiful River Wye, and again, I did a little bit of rugby during the winter time. And so I thoroughly enjoyed my life that way, but I, being one of the lads, I suppose, the YMCA, I was very interested in the drama there. And so I began getting quite interested in everything that had to do with drama. What from the radio to various organizations, such as drama festivals and so on. And I found this something very exciting, that the excitement of actually going on a stage, I found very stimulating.
How old were you when you finished your education?
Oh, I think I must have been about 15 and a half, something like that.
About 1929 or 30.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Did you get a job on leaving school?
Oh, yes, but I had an uncle who had a farm outside Hereford, which is a very large farm, and he asked me to come out and help him out because he not only farmed, but he sold agricultural implements. And so I had a sort of wandering commission on his behalf. And I liked it very much, of course. At least going out on the country life, it was delightful, from Herefordshire right up into the Black Mountains. Absolutely delightful area. And, of course, next door to his farm was Sir Charles Pulley's horse training department, you know, where not only were they born, but they were trimmed there ready for racing. And so my cousin became a horse trainer there, and I found that very interesting. I went along there and sat on some of these lovely horses.
Did you think, before the Second World War, of joining any military service organization, like the army?
I'd been in rep in the Birmingham area. I came down to London and went into South London area, rep, and I can't think of the name of the place now. But I was very interested in there, but I found I had a bit of a bad spell, so I tried to enlist in the Rhodesian police force, and that was in 1938, I think, yes. And that was, I was eventually accepted. But towards the end of that, they came along, that's the Crown agents for the colonists, and said, look, we'd like you now to swap to the Palestine police. And if you do, if the war starts, or if anything like that happens, then we'll see that you get to where you want to go.
So you didn't actually start in the police force in Rhodesia?
I didn't go to Rhodesia at all, no. I was on what they call the detachment list. But because of this, they said if you would change over, because there seems to be some threats of war coming up. So in 1939, I did. I changed over and went to Palestine.
Did you mind going to Palestine instead of Rhodesia?
Not really, because I had an uncle who was a parson in Wales, and he thought keeping the peace in the Holy Land was a thing that I should do. But sort of said, oh yes, do go, you see, etc. and all that. And he had all this bit of backing. Anyhow, I went, and I didn't mind it at all. But it was a time when the troubles were building up, because of course Hitler was persecuting the Jews, and they were getting on anything that would take them to the Holy Land, or to Britain, or to America. The trouble was, you see, when they got to the Holy Land, I think the Jewish population was 11%, and they were assisted, of course, by America. Now, I found out when I was there that that was the devil in the woodpile, you know, because it meant that they obtained arms from the Americans. Not only that, and lots of money came by. And so when the League of Nations was finally privatized by America and taken home to America with everything else that went with it, and everything changed. And in Palestine, of course, the situation was building up, that the Jews were coming in, and of course we felt so sorry for them, because they were in such a terrible state, you know. And they were coming in, dreadful situations. And so we turned a blind eye occasionally, but one of the things you couldn't do was to break any sort of law which the government stipulated, trying to control the amount of immigration. Now, what the Jews had set about doing was to go into various areas, and because of the money coming from America, they were able to purchase land from the Arabs. And they made this strategic places, you know, so that they could form quite a little union, and they'd try and join up, you see. And eventually, the High Commissioner said, we'll have to stop this. So he passed a law, which was put into abeyance, saying that every change of land from Arab to Jew must be sanctioned by his office. And of course, in 1940, that law was promulgated. And it was quite a straightforward law. All it said was all they needed was permission, and the permission wouldn't be granted by the sound of it. And so it put up what I would call the worst riots we'd ever seen in Palestine, or ever will. They were called the land riots law. And this is how it all started. You see, the Palestine Post, the local newspaper, they said on, the 8th of March, 1940, that's right, reference the Land Act in force and plus riots. Decree vitiates prophecy. Chief Rabbi's message to the Archbishop of Canterbury, when he arrived in Rhodes on his way back to Palestine from London, His Eminence the Chief Rabbi, Dr. Isaac Herzog, who reached Jerusalem on Friday, sent the following cablegram to the Archbishop of Canterbury. On my way back to the Holy Land, I was shocked by the evil tidings that the land transfer regulations had just been enacted. This is a terrible blow to Israel in the most tragic hour in our history, denying us equal rights in the land of our fathers and dooming us to the ghetto in a land divinely promised to Israel. This fatal decree vitiates the biblical prophecy. In God's name, I appeal to your grace. do your utmost to remove this crying wrong inflicted upon downtrodden Israel. And the next day there started riots which lasted for 3 days. And
were you personally involved?
Oh, yes. We went into Tel Aviv, of course, and we were stoned and things thrown at us. You know, we had the usual rough house. We wore steel helmets, which was a good thing, because in Bene Yehuda Street, we were really up against it. It seemed the whole damn population of Israel were against us. And a piece of coping stone came down, hit that side of my head. I had a steel helmet on, so it didn't hit anybody. It came down and broke two fingers and one thumb.
On your right hand?
On my right hand, which is a bit difficult, because I had a pickaxe in that hand. And then, of course, this went on, as I say, and it caused, I should think, the bitterness caused by that never left the population. So if we began a situation there which was a surprising development, because the money and coming in from America into Palestine was considerable, and we of course couldn't stop that. But this enabled them to buy arms around, you know, and they began storing it up. But as far as I understood, the text of all this was organized by various eminent people within the Jewish faith. They seemed to be there, seemed to be all one person who would start something and off they'd go, and you'd have this trouble. But eventually, of course, it became so bad, they came in, of course, and we were terribly sorry for them. It was appalling, appalling the conditions they came in. And as far as I could remember, children were in a terrible state, and etc. So we gradually began letting them in, of course. I mean, this was, you can't leave them in the ships on the shore. And they were coming in on all sorts of situations. Right. Now, of course, the problem that we found was that as far as the police were concerned, keeping the peace in Palestine was in an impossible situation, quite impossible, because usually a police force acts on information coming from the public, but the public now, they just got at each other and they didn't want to know us. As a matter of fact, we seem to be fighting against Arab and Jew, and this meant that throughout the whole of Palestine, we were having a pretty difficult time. And so the next evil problem, I think, was the way that these ships that were turned out of Germany, that came out of Germany, they went round the Mediterranean looking for places to take them in. And it was in, the situation was they eventually headed for Palestine, and usually wrecked themselves. Often the crew would take to the lifeboats and clear off and just run the ship aground. Now, what can you do? We had what we called clearance camps in the area where we could put these people immediately. But again, it so happened that when the war started and the Vichy French got involved, north of us, Syria became Vichy. Now there was a 28,000 ton coal-burning ship called the Patria. She was French-owned, and she'd put into Haifa because of a fear of German submarines and what have you. But the trouble was she was also out of coal. And so the captain said, oh no, he's coaling, and then he was leaving. But the GOC said, he's not taking that ship back, that ship now stays here. And so he said, we leave you, the police, to deal with the situation. So we dealt with it. And they moved the crew very early in the morning, you know. And we took them up to Syria and said, right, off you go. And this ship was there, empty. It had been sailing between North Africa and Syria, taking Spadis. And these were horsemen who were going to serve in Syria. So they got horse boxes all along the front of this ship. But the Navy had a good look at it and said, this, we can use this. And they took off all these. But at the same time this happened, two Danubian steamers came in. And they were going to dump themselves on the coast. But you could smell them. And they were called the Milos and the Pacific. And they were Danubian steamers, Milos and the Pacific. And they came in and they just appealed, and of course we went aboard. And it was appalling. They had got, they were nearly 3,000 people jammed in, and some of them hadn't moved since they got on the steamer. And they'd arranged boxes around the outside of the ship, and they sat on there and used that as a toilet. So the side of the ship. And on board they got enteric fever. I mean, so we couldn't do anything about that. We said no. And eventually the GOC said, right, put them on the Patria. See? And we'll take them away, wash them up a bit, and take them away to Mauritius. And then they can come back afterwards. So we did. Started that. He called in the army to give us a hand, and they started helping us to transfer them. And of course, they all got bathed and washed and sat that. Then.
You personally were doing this, were you?
Oh, yes, I was involved in it because I was doing the checking. Because you see, one of the things that we were concerned about was the fact that it would be very simple for the Germans to place a poor Jew in the middle of that who could be a spy. And spying was our big headache. We'd already caught two, mine, earlier on. They were trying to get to Britain by just going through the Balkans, you see, down into the Middle East. So we had a bit of difficulty with this. What we got was an interview system which set out A, B, C, D, and we started interviewing them, their names, where they came from, etc., etc., what town did they live in, could they give us the names of streets in that town, did they know any Jews in Palestine, a variety of questions like that, which would give us an idea, you see. And we eventually, of course, began to work mainly on single people. They seem to be the ones who might be, if a man with a family is unlikely to be a spy of any kind. So we began grading them, those that might be Roman. And we got them settled down, a And they were in a very nice situation there because they felt so wonderful. And then they started loading it with coal. And they were told that they could have, oh yes, we objected in the first place from anyone from the Jewish Authority coming on board. But we were ordered by London to allow rabbis and people like that on board, and so they came on board. Mind me, we were very careful in checking them. But this coaling was done by Arabs mainly, doing the manual work, brought in barges in sacks and taken up into the engine room, you know, and dumped there. Now, this went on, and she was ready for sailing when, on a Saturday morning at 9:20, I'd come up from quite an early start and was on the deck, smoking actually, in a clearance area where there was no rail, of course, because that's where the gangway down, we took it away so that they couldn't use it to get away, you know, jump in and swim ashore or anything like that. And I was leaning on the smoking like that, and bang, there was a terrible shudder. And I felt, didn't hear anything, but I felt this push, and I swung around and tried to grab the rail and went down into the water. But of course, I could swim, so I swam to the...
Swam to the what?
To the levee. The levee. The levee was set on the west side of the port. So I swam onto there, and of course things began to happen on board. And one of my colleagues, a great friend of mine, who was written an account of all this, of course, he stayed on board, but I didn't have any choice. I had to get off straight away, you see. I was soaking wet. But eventually, I think the bomb had been brought on in the coaling system, and it had been placed under the engine. I think what they intended to do was to disable the engine. This is what they wanted. But instead of that happening, as one of the investigators told me, he said, the blast went down. You see, the engine was much heavier, and so it blew a hole in the side of the ship. And she started going over like that in little bits, you know, on the starboard side, I think. Anyhow, as I swam away, I could see that she was coming my way, so I got out of the way fast, of course. But the thing about this was, the army was called in straight away with their trucks, and these people were transferred that were able to be transferred. And unfortunately, there were 263 people drowned, and including one of our fellows, Busty Burford, I think his name was. He'd gone down to shut off the steam, let it off, so there wouldn't be an explosion. But apparently some of the furniture collapsed and fell on him. And we lost him, of course. And that was a bitter blow. But again, you see, the down the coast, about 6-7 miles down the coast, was a place called Athlete. And it had a clearance camp there right by the sea. It's a beautiful camp that would be used by the army and for various other things. And so they decided to take them there, and the army took them in trucks down to there. And they got in. But because of the nature of the huts, the women went to the right and the men went to the left. Never the twain shall meet except on parade ground, you see. But so they were separated out. And they began to get a bit agitated there, so the army came and did guard duty around the camp. And of course, we wondered what was going to happen next, but we'd already got the message, you know, that they were going to be moved. And they persuaded a Dutch company and its captain, who were coming into Haifa, to take them. At first he was point blank, but finally he was persuaded to take them down to Mauritius. And so, I can't remember the name of that ship, but it so happened that the army and us, we had one hell of a job trying to get them to leave that camp. And the last thing they did was to take off all their clothes, you see. And then stood there. So there was a standoff for about 2 hours. And the army came up with blankets. And we took all the men, knowing if the men went, the women would follow. And we put them on board, on these trucks. And they were taken to Haifa and put on board the ship there. And eventually away she went. I think I stayed behind because there was a lot of sorting out in documents and what have you. And they managed to go without escort all the way down to Mauritius. And we did some necessary clearing up in that particular area in that camp. And that was the end of that situation. But my golly, the situation became, after that, became almost impossible, because they were coming in now into Palestine at such a rate, you know, with ships being run onto the beach, that sort of thing. And not only that, we had the awful situation that some of them are already getting into this violent business of not only attacking the local Palestinians, but always taking shots at us, the police. And so we gave up, we said we can't win this. It's got to end somewhere, you know. And well, I could leave it there for a bit, shouldn't I? Yes, it so happened that the situation was getting so bad that not only did we have to step up the police, but the army became involved. And it meant that life was a very tricky thing, because some of these situations involved mass killings. For instance, begging surrounding a village early hours of the morning and then opening up and massacring everyone in the village. Now that went down, of course, in the annuals of the Palestinians as a original attack coming from America. And they said all these attacks that are being sponsored by America are American, and the hate of anything American, and of course Britain being the friend of America, it made our situation pretty awful, inasmuch as two sergeants who had gone into Tel Aviv.
Real too.